Welcome to the second day of our Yachikala, dealing with areas of Kashrus. Today I have the pleasure to give a word of introduction to my good friend Rabbi Menachem, Rabbi Ganak. Rabbi Ganak wears many hats, but it's not so important the hats he wears. What's underneath the hat is important. A superb Talmud Chacham whose headgear is a Keser Torah. And the OU, if I could comment as an outsider and consumer, I think was extremely wise in choosing Rabbi Ganak, a person of his learning ability, a Talmud Chacham Muvok, a Bal Chesed, a capable person to head what maybe is the largest kashrus institution in the world. I'm not sure in Eretz Yisrael if they have something equivalent, but surely a respected and a kashrus institution that we all depend on. My friendship with Rabbi Ganak goes back, I would say, 35 years maybe, when he used to come to the Mir Yeshiva in the summer and he would sit on the bench next to me and we talked in learning and we got to know each other. And over the years I've seen him, the yeshiva which I'm involved in with Englewood, he is one of the passionate advocates to make it a hospitable place for the yeshiva to grow. And he is a wonderful friend and a superb Talmud Chacham. It's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Ganak to discuss areas of kashrus, and you'll, Rabbi Ganak, decide the forum. People will ask questions, however, you'll feel comfortable doing that.
It's a pleasure to be here today with the Westside Kollel. As Reb Dunn mentioned, we go back a long time. I told him a story there which he didn't remember, but I'm going to tell it to you anyhow, which I thought he had told me in the name of Rebel Soloveitchik, that when the Shagas Arya first came to Metz, so he said, you know, he'd give a shir. So they said, what do you want to give a shir? So he told about whatever you want to shir on. You write down the Mamakoymus, I'll give the shir. So, you know, the Balabatim he gave them a real opening. So they took what they thought was the most obscure, unrelated area. They started writing all the places in Shas which says Salamandria. And just if they were iron. So the Shagas Arya comes in, it takes the Ma'am Akimus, and he sees, you know, all this disjointed. So he says, Weist ois as Metz is a stadt from London. Nitto as a sort sphere sugiri Salamandria. And he went on. Not being the Shagas Arya, they're smart enough to write the questions before which I reviewed. But just by way of introduction, then maybe I think instead of my speaking and giving a formal speech, I was thinking of giving a shir and davar shesh matirin. Don't tell me, get with the program, so I'm not doing that.
Maybe it's a different occasion.
Right, on a different occasion, okay. The OU is indeed one of the largest, probably the largest kashrus agency in the world, certainly in the United States. And I want to acknowledge Jerry Feldheim as a member of our Kashrus Commission, who's with us. We supervise now about 6,000 plants in about 78 countries around the globe. And that itself tells you, not only in terms of the OU, what's changed in terms of large agencies is the globalization of Kashrus. When I first came to the Kashrus division, it was much, much smaller. Now we have about 50 rabbis working, about 100 people just on my floor. When I first came, there was 1.5 people working in the OU Kashrus division. It was Rabbi Reese, he was half that time, and Rabbi Lifshitz, who was my predecessor. But what's changed in terms of the general world economy, but of course that affects also Kashrus, is this extraordinary globalization, that sources of supply come from every place in on the globe, the most obscure places that you can imagine. We're dealing with an issue now about in Tibet, which is it's such a godforsaken place that you have to go on a donkey to get to the place where they were going. And that wasn't just the melitza, that was the fact. And they use yak milk. It's one of the industries to produce casein. Casein is the milk protein. And it's one of the sources, companies are looking towards it for sources of supply. So the question is, which we're still grappling with, is can you set up a kashrus system in in Tibet. What about the issues of Chalav Akum? Does Rav Moshe have to apply to Tibet? How isolated, you know, even though they say that they use these kalim, these utensils, which they get the milk only for the milk production, yak is a kosher animal. Is that the case? Can we rely on that? And if they're not, do we say Stam Kilim in B'nei Yonam? So there are a lot of different issues that emerge, and this is in Tibet. So it's just an indication of how far flung is the kashrus, you know, reach in terms of getting source of supply for industrial companies that used to be very staid and would only have a very limited in terms of their supplies. They were very loyal to their suppliers. They would stick with their suppliers. Now that's not the case at all. There's much more fluidity and flux within the industry. And of course that presents for us many new problems and issues in terms of evaluating ingredients, storing information about them, trying to be on top of what's happening in the industry. And to that end, we have a special department within the OU that evaluates the status of different ingredients. We have hundreds of thousands of ingredients within our database which have been evaluated, that are being used by different OU companies. So the growth itself represents a challenge, both in terms of being on top of the new technology and in terms of the halachic issues that they present. There are always new areas within food technology, use of enzymes and other microbial rennet was you know, relatively recent. When I say relatively, within the last 20, 25 years became a common ingredient of rennet. Used to be that there was one company in Israel, Frankenthal, that was the source of all the rennet that was used in all the kosher cheeses. And that's no longer the case. So that's part of what makes kashrus interesting. Part, it's the nexus of technology, halacha, economics, politics, of course, because politics is the glue that keeps all human relations together, and for good or ill. And that's what is, you know, the dynamic area within the OU, which is true of all kashrus agencies. Also, we deal with many different kashrus agencies, both in the United States and in Eretz Yisrael and in Europe, because the OU doesn't use only OU ingredients. It evaluates the ingredients if it meets what we think are appropriate standards. We'll use them. And that's really, the OU could have used it's rather substantial clout, because just within the United States, the OU is probably twice the size of all the other kashrus agencies, of the large ones that you're familiar with combined. So we could have used that leverage to insist that we be completely vertically integrated. There are other agencies that try to do that for the people, you know, on a feeding chain smaller than them. And we don't do that. And actually, the Rav Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha, once told me, said that he was very much opposed to that. He thought, he was very concerned, not only related to the OU, but he was, being the brisker that was, like Rav Chaim, he believed more in the individual than he believed in organizations. He was very much a Jeffersonian in that respect, and he thought it was dangerous to have so much, you know, authority or power or influence within any organization. They tell the story about Rav Chaim, and later on, they don't tell it every Aguda convention, but anyway, that was Rav Chaim only went to the first Aguda convention. He didn't go subsequently, and it wasn't just a coincidence. It was because, even though the Aguda then especially was run, you know, by such giants in our history, Chaim Reus and others, but this was always a concern that to have organizations, things will always go wrong within an organization, and too much power will grow within the, you know, the context of such an organization. So that's something that we're sensitive about as we grow, but it represents also an internal challenge, how to, you know, to monitor yourself, to try to stay honest. So those are some of the challenges. It's not just the globalization of the technology, but the internal recognition of, you know, what we should do correctly, because there's no question sometimes we blunder, and sometimes we blunder very badly. Obviously people are very sensitive to, you know, what's being done now, especially after the scandal in Muncie, and we're rethinking also different systems that are in place. But each new challenge reminds you that you have to do things better. And ultimately, the OU sign has it now on the bottom, says mark of trust. But the trust is, you know, it's a trust that is given to us by the community, by the Jewish community, by the kosher consumer, and something that we have to remember every day that we have to live up to, and as we will stumble, as inevitably we will, you know, it reminds us again that you have to, who ultimately we're responsible to, and ultimately, of course, it's the Torah and the Baruch Shem. So, you know, I thought, instead of my giving a speech, if anybody wants my shtickles on Davar Sheyesh Matir, I'm glad I have it written out to mail it to you, but so maybe I'll just answer any questions anybody might have. And through that, you know, I'll get the points that I have in mind.
As of recent, I assume it's related to what went on in Muncie. When you buy meat, and it has multiple hashgachas, Rabashim now has an OU, Helen meat, when you see multiple hashgachas on, particularly meat or chicken, does that mean the OU is there or not there? Or
mm-hmm.
And if so, what's the other mashgiach doing?
Right. Well, the OU supervises or certifies every single, I shouldn't say every, but almost every large meat operation, chicken or meat, in the United States. So Rubash, you mentioned, has many different levels of supervision. It has Karl Dachi Shurim lawyers, but it has also Rabbi Weissmandel gives Hashkocha there. And we work very closely with Rubashkin, with agri-processes. I've been there myself several times. We send our own person, aside from that there's a person, Rabbi Meisels, who reports to us, but we send our own person, Seth Mandel, who goes to inspect all the different meat operators. That's his full-time job, only doing that. So he goes to different hashgachas to check. He himself is an interesting story, just an interesting person. I know Seth a long way back, because I know him from Boston. He was the valedictorian of Brookline High, very smart guy, won a merit scholarship, went to Harvard, was a Fulbright scholar, and Rav Soloveitchik made him from. And he's a very big Talmud Chacham, and no Shechita, and I just want to say the standard person is working with for the OU, has a Fulbright scholarship, graduated Harvard summa cum laude, you know.
And Rabbi Weissman
with him. Right. He's working on it. Yeah, he went to Yale. Our experience in the United States, and I don't know exactly what the reason is that we don't find, as we do in Eretz Yisrael, that the flour is infested with bugs. What happens is, of course, if you keep flour a long time, so then it can become infested. But generally speaking, we don't sift in our homes, as they do in Israel, we don't sift the flour. Now, I went to see one of General Mills' flour plants. It was in Buffalo, and I went through the system that they have. They have a machine that what it does is, and it does it several times. I presume they do this in Israel also, but what limits the infestation is there are always a certain amount of, you know, eggs that potentially could hatch of insects in the flour. So they take the flour as it's being sifted, and the flour is pushed against the sides at very high speeds of this machine, and it breaks, it shatters the eggs, so they never hatch, and so the bugs never develop. They're buckled, therefore, because they never create a barrier. And generally speaking, we don't find a problem. You know, the problem sometimes is if you mark it about yoshin, and people will store flour over a long period of time, then you have to be more careful. That we found a few years ago. There was a yoshin bakery, and the supply of yoshin wasn't just a bakery. One of the suppliers of Yashin flour, because, you know, storing the flour for a long time, so then, you know, problems can arise. But generally speaking, given the turnover time and the way flour is handled in the United States, we don't find a flour problem that requires sifting. Yanti?
Discuss the post-Muncie era and what we've done to remedy the ills that possibly led up to some of those problems.
Right. Well, we're still in the midst of the post-Muncie era. I mean, there were the OU itself was not directly affected only by the grace of God, because we don't supervise, generally speaking, local establishments that we believe is the province of the local Rabbonim or the local Vadim. So most of the problems that emerge are generally problems in local establishments. The reason for that is most of the Schlachthausen, I should say most, I can't say all, but most of the Schlachthausen in the United States, and those who are producing, whether it be Ali, Rubashkin, or so on, they're from people. They themselves are, well, you know, are concerned about the issue. That itself is not a guarantee, but at least it's the beginning. And the supervision in place is pretty good. The problem is, and also the problem is when it goes to the distributors, and from the distributors to the local store, you know, at those points, there are potential places where it can be a breakdown in the system. And that's what happened very dramatically in Muncie. The one who responded most dramatically is Empire. Empire said that it will no longer sell chickens just in an ice pack like it used to. It's going to, starting in a few weeks, sell all its chickens. They're going to be shrink-wrapped with a hologram on them. Now, the holograms can be forged. It's not easy to do, but it can be done. But what we're looking to do is not to make it impossible. This is, you know, it's only, you know, $2 piece of chicken we're talking about. So we're just trying to get that the incentive, the financial incentive of it is matched by the difficulty of creating a symbol, a simen. We know that the plumbers that have been used from time immemorial are completely inadequate. Many of them don't close. They can be reproduced, but you don't even have to reproduce them. You can, you know, just garner them from someplace. So we're thinking and looking at kind of different systems that are cost effective and can be used, which will give better security. One of the things that we've done is many of the different distributors, one of the largest distributors in the New York area is Westside. It's not in from auspices, but it's very well supervised, and we have access to all. Actually, that's supervised by the OU. The Rabbi Lavovitz is the mashgiach who goes there, and he has access to all the information on online. So we have to do that in all the other different distributors. Now, we don't even know how many distributors are, because there are, you know, different levels of distribution, but the large ones now have agreed to come into some kind of, under some kind of supervision or monitoring. So it's going to require a mix of different things: monitoring better the distributors, finding a better simon kashrus. Empire has done it in terms of what it's doing now. It's taking a little bit of a gamble, because obviously the butchers are not happy about this. Butchers make their living by butchering pieces of meat. Here, the Empire is telling the consumer, you should buy an Empire chicken that comes completely sealed, and let the butcher, if he wants to cut it up for you, cut it up in front of you. That'll obviously give you a much better sense of security. But we have to develop more secure simonim, better monitoring of the distribution, and the local vadim have to monitor the different establishments that are under them, the local stuff, whether it be restaurants or butcher shops or supermarkets, whatever it is. They have to do it much more effectively, obviously. So we, at least in the OU, I've been looking in with our staff is looking into different potential simonim. Some are very louder. Some are very interesting, but we don't know, you know, where they're going to lead. We've been looking into holograms. There's a company in Israel together with DuPont that's developed holograms that can be used, and we've actually begun using them on wines. The VAD in Montreal already has begun using them on their chickens. But there are other interesting suggestions. This the most interesting one I saw, but it's way down the line because it doesn't have FDA approval. One suggestion was there's a company that makes a DNA spray. Now, it's created a unique DNA, and, you know, it's even more unique than a person's DNA, because it's a combination of different botanical DNAs, and we all know that, you know, DNA, each person's DNA is very unique. I mean, we all know, except for one jury in California, but generally speaking, we know that it's unique, and if they could create, which is what they've done already, a spray that forensically can be tested. So you're not going to test it every time, because it's expensive to test it. But there are ways of checking to see that at least that the plumber, which will have a little bit of the DNA, I use the word plumber in quotes, matches the DNA spray on the product. Now, this is an interesting idea. It will require FDA approval. It's not yet FDA approved. So that itself, to get FDA approval is a process of probably a year or close to a year. So, but those are potential, new kinds of simonim down the line. But it's something that we're actually looking at and have been working with different distributors and companies to create, that mix between the simon and the monitoring of the distribution.
How would you do that on meat? You can't put a hologram on every piece of meat?
No. So on meat, what the two things, again, if we would use a spray, we would spray every piece of meat. Actually, the one who brought this idea to us was Yom Chutin, or Shia Hamda, but through somebody else. The hologram would have to be linked somehow to the piece of meat, but not through a plumber. There was a different kind of way of attaching it to the meat. But the holograms are not inexpensive, so you can't just shoot it all over each one. So they have ways of attaching it. There was one company I spoke to the other day. It's a company in Israel in Caesarea, and he has a unique ink that could be written on a. Again, but then the question is how you attach it. But this unique ink means that there are certain trace elements to it that can't be reproduced by anybody else without, enormous difficulty. But, but then there's a cost factor. I said, listen, this is just a piece of chicken. This, it tells me that the different governments are using them on pairs. This is not to be meant to be an anti-terrorist, program. Just to secure the chickens.
Aside from just checking that
well, I mean, ultimately what you have to do is rely on the supervision. But you really, it's important, I think, to, when you go, for example, to a restaurant, to make sure that it's under supervision. Which, of course, if it's something that you're going to every week, you don't, and you're familiar with it. But things change. We had a company, a restaurant that was under the OU, and we decided that we didn't want to continue supervising them. Not that we caught them with anything, we didn't have confidence in the owner. And we took away the supervision. And if they'll do it, the people should think about it. Not just like it's an entitlement that you can go to any restaurant that's there. And that's if you go to a catering, a wedding, it's important always to speak to the mashgiach. Whose hashgach is it under? Speak to the mashgiach. It raises the level. It's not just in this case, but I meant to say on a public policy level, it raises it. It's sort of like. Doctors are told they don't use, they don't use antibiotics with abandon because a lot of these microbes are becoming resistant to antibiotics. It's not this patient or that patient, but globally, that people have to be more sensitive about kashrus and raise the ante by telling people, this is important. And there may be in this process that we're talking about, there may be costs attendant to it, so people have to be willing to absorb minor costs that will be required, for example, if the simonim become more expensive and things like that.
Does the OU have different kinds of mashgiach in terms of mashgiach committee or mashgiach with yotzei? And if so, what are the criteria that you use to determine what kind of level of mashgiach you have?
Well, there are. Depending on the nature of the product, whether it's a yotzev nichlus or mashgiach tmidi is what determines it. But for example, all meat products and all restaurants under the OU have a mashgiach tmidi, not a yotzev nichlus. And also, if it's a company that has kosher and non-kosher productions in the same plant, so the kosher productions will be done with hashgacha tmidis. So those are the main criteria in terms of hashgacha tmidis, depending on the nature of the product. Obviously, if it's wine, it requires hashgacha tmidis, a wine production.
Right, but if, let's say, it's a vegetarian restaurant or a place where there's no meat, then you would rely on
the other. Well, actually, in our dairy restaurants, we also have mashgichim tmidim. But that's the OU's policy. Some of these things are issues of policy. Some places may have a good yotzev nichlus for that, but there are a lot of issues that come up, especially if it's a restaurant that's using cheese. There are other things that require chosam, it's not just meat. And then there are always the issues of Bishul Akum, especially in the restaurant. You know, hopefully, if it's a restaurant, they're selling you product that's Oyla Shulchan Malachim. You would think. Or, yeah, Harry.
on lettuce, they serve by a caterer. How it's handled, if it can be served, and what is the OU or its rabbinic position on how to or whether one should handle ordinary or homemade lettuce, let's say, at home.
Right. Well, actually, the speaker after me is Rabbi Eisen. He's really the better person to, because he's one of the experts on actually in this area. When he used to work at the OU before he went there, that was one of his areas of special focus, and he wrote a very good book, a manual about vegetables. But in terms of what we do in our restaurants, the romaine lettuce, for example, the lettuces that we have to be careful about in terms of infestation, aphids, and so on. Each of these lettuces, in each restaurant, the mashkiach has a light box, which is just a light underneath a piece of lucite, clear lucite, so he can check, because the light is coming from underneath, it highlights the insects, and he's trained to spot insects on the leaf. He checks a certain amount of lettuce to make sure that it's completely clean, and it's an extremely time-consuming process. And a big part of what the mashgiach does in a restaurant now is this issue of checking lettuce. There are certain, of course, there are different lettuces. You don't check everything. The outer leaves are discarded because they are more likely to be infested. But if you're using, when I was growing up, we never used romaine lettuce except for Pesach. Now everybody uses it all the time. So it requires a lot of intensive handling. And in terms of the real procedure, I would recommend, Rabbi Eisen is really, I'm sure it's going to be part of what he speaks about, because it's one of his areas.
Are there vegetables that are taboo? Asparagus?
Yes.
Broccoli?
Right.
So broccoli. Allow those to function?
Right. Unless it's Bodek. Bodek, for example, is a company that it's under the OU. It's also Rabbi Gissinger in Lakewood gives special hashgacha for it. And basically what they do, once the broccoli is problematic, the aphids and so on, they're so embedded in the florets of the broccoli, you can't get it out. So what you do is you make sure that you're getting it in an area and in a season when the infestation level is minor. And that api halacha means that if the infestation rate is less than miut hamatzui, which means it's a miut she'eno matzui, which we generally assume most poskim agree with, the except the opinion of the Mishnah Siyankov, who says that it's less than 10%. Of course, even that 10% number means 10% of what, but 10% level. So then it doesn't require bedika. If it's above 10%, it does require bedika. And these things change based on the season, the place, the climate, the acidity in the land. So there are a lot of factors that will affect, what's the likelihood that something will be infested. Greener products are more infested than things that are not as colored. And obviously, if it has many folds, for example, iceberg lettuce is rarely infested. If you just take, the outer leaves off, two or three layers off, and you get more of a bald head, talk about the lettuce, then it's, you're home free. No, everything is all one policy. In other words, what we try to do is to have a hashgacha that we think that a person can lechatchila rely on, but people know that there's certain coolers that the OU was relying on. The most, and I say certain, I say that the most dramatic of which, or the most important and the most pervasive, is that we rely that the chol of what the Moshe calls the chol of our companies. This had to, is known in the Moshe Feinstein's name, but it's not just the Moshe, it goes way back before the Moshe. Really, Miko did the Chazanishal that way as well, that the supervision of either because in our areas, generally non-kosher species are not milked, Ein Be'edro Tomei, that there's government supervision and laws in terms of what can be sold as milk. And Rav Moshe says that's like you saw the ale, because obviously people will talk about it. Then the question becomes, well, what about countries outside the United States where, you know, where the government supervision is much more lax, or potential corruption? That's what I spoke about, you know, in Tibet and areas like that. What do we think about it then? I know they asked Rav Moshe about Poland, right? And he thought that if that's the law in Poland, even though it's Poland, you know, that would be okay. So, but in general, that's, you know, we don't have, the only place where we started is in Eretz Yisrael. There was a time that we called everything in Eretz Yisrael, you know, the standard that we had was generally that things produced in Eretz Yisrael would be called Mahadrin. Now, Mahadrin is a phrase that grew up in Israel. You know, it's right after Hanukkah, so we know more familiar with it. But it really, it's very hard to know what's Mahadrin. One person's Mahadrin, another person's Mahadrin. It's not Alpidin, it's not, Mahadrin only appears in Orach Chaim. You don't have the word Mahadrin in your day. It's very difficult to define. But most of the things, unless indicated otherwise, coming from Eretz Yisrael, are Chol of Yisrael. But that's because of the Israeli market and so on. How does the psak? What's the system of psak halacha? So we have different poskim within the OU. The primary poskim are Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Shechter, Rabbi Herschel Shechter, and all the shilas that come. And I'm also involved with that area. All the shilas that come are codified, written down, and we have a person who actually writes down all the shilas. We have them computerized, you know. So if a shaila came up, I could say, you know, what was the OU, you know, what's our position about this? What's the data, namely the data, both the actual, you know, the data in terms of the realia, what's the data in terms of what, you know, what are the shailas and tshuvas about this? So all of this is written down. There's a fellow in my office, David Mintz, who's sort of like the safra, the diner, and he sits with Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Shechter, you know, each week when they come in, and they're done on all these different shailas.
So what's the right, or is it...
we resolve it always within the OU, but sometimes if there'll be an important issue that we think, you know, that Belsky or Shechter think they want to have other guidance, though, you know, the Mishailis that we've sent to Rav Yoshev, but it's handled mainly within the OU. Michael.
In fact, I could just make a suggestion and also a semi question. Very often when I travel and there's an OU Hashkacha and it's milchik, it says it's not Kol HaYisrael. For many people who are maximum college Israel to be traveling and to be stuck, you know, ordering a kosher meal, and it very often says Mahadrin on it, which I'm not sure kind of why anything which is not college Israel would ever say Mahadrin. I think, I don't know if the OU has a policy in terms of the defining the words that it uses in terms of something college Israel or not. I think Mahadrin, by definition, cannot be college Israel. But if it's possible to have, you know, kind of when there is a hashkacha that's given, that people who are not necessarily, you know, because non-college soul users that are going to their college souls are going to have to rely on it, like traveling, like Wilson's or Bornstein, that they raise the level of their shock.
Right. We've heard this lots of times, I mean, and it's a good point, and we've raised it with the companies. The phrase Mahadrin, I apologize, you know, again, you know, I come back to what I said before. It's just, you know, it's like certain words that people are just became consumer phrases and are not in any way rooted in halacha. For example, Mahadrin is one, glat is another, right? The word glat appears on things that, you know, are not meaningful. Chickens, for example, they write glatt. So that's a soil. There's sometimes shilas about the reyes, and that's a soil. They have Newcastle pieces, things that we don't have in the United States. I mean, so, but when people mean glatt, they mean to say it's super, you know, in their mind, at least they're super kosher, something like that, whatever that means. But in terms of that, the meals that people use on airlines, should all the dairy ones, should be Chol of Yisrael, you know, we've spoken to the companies about it. We can't impose it on them because, you know, that's what they're selling. But it's a suggestion that we may. We understand that there's some people who are flying are only, you know, Chol of Yisrael people, only want Chol of Yisrael, so that obviously it's not like you have so many options when you're in a plane where you're going to go. But what you have to realize is the generally speaking, the airlines, especially after 9/11, began to de-emphasize because they were in such bad shape financially. So some of them completely got rid of not just kosher meals, but you know, used to get a meal on every airline flight that you went to. When you flew from New York to Washington, you got a whole meal flying for half an hour. So they've gotten rid of a lot of the meals. But one of the things which was a special course of them is the special meals, not only kosher but general. They have a whole range of special meals, and the airlines have given much less to the companies to produce those meals. I mean, it affects both the quality of the meal. Mentioned Wilton, and it's not so much the quality is not always the problem of Wilton in terms of what it produces. It's that, you know, there isn't such a big demand obviously for the kosher meals, so the quality it's held in distribution for a long time. Given what they're giving the company to produce the meal, and they have certain requirements, Chol Yisrael for some of them became an issue. The additional cost was the difficulty for them. So, you know, we can ask them to do it, but given the economic realities, some of them just, you know, don't respond. There are, though, those that do. Like, well, Weiss is, all of it is Chol Yisrael.
I get the impression that the OU did away with the distinction between dairy and dairy equipment.
Yeah, it never had DE. We never wrote DE. We always wrote OD, OUD. And what we include in the D is, here we are concerned about the Chol Yisrael people. So anything, if you're not Chol Yisrael, so a lot of the things that we write OUD or DE are irrelevant, because it could be just a not by not, wouldn't be. The reason we don't write OUD, I think the Chav K does, is because we consider it a complicated, you know, for the few people who know the difference between whether something's not by not in terms of 6 hours, it's very confusing for we're not interested just, you know, to help a few people in Borough Park and the West Side, and, you know, we're reaching out to the broad American population, and DE is another complication. And it's not only that, it's also difficult to monitor, because DE means that we know that the equipment was clean and there's no be'en, and it's only a shaila related to the kalim. But we don't always know that. It means we have to monitor, you know, to affirm that there's another level of inspection that would be required, that, you know, the amount of be'en that's left from one production to the next is certainly butl, or that it's only a shaila. So we don't want to take that additional responsibility in what we consider to be a confusing, another level that might be confusing to an unsophisticated consumer. So that's why we don't write DE. But we do write OUD for everything that has that milk is produced on the equipment, and we do that even though there would be cases where if you considered Chol of our companies, as Moshe calls it, Chol of Stam, to be Hector, then it would just be a not but not. We wouldn't have to write OUD. It wouldn't be OUD. But whenever milk is used, we do, because we're going to the Chumrah, even if you're makbid on Chol Yisrael and you think that it's Isura, so it's not only, so it acts as the Kalim, so that's why, so you should be aware of that.
You advise people to wait 6 hours for anything that you need, regardless of the ingredients,
obviously. Yeah, I mean, no, unless you know otherwise. I mean, we get a lot of consumers who will call, and we have information about certain products, and we'll tell you, well, you know, this we know is just, either the amount is, you know, sometimes we'll even write OUD when the amount is bottled, because dairy is listed on, so there shouldn't be a steer between what's written on the ingredient panel and what's written, you know, in terms of the label. And some things are written dairy. I showed the other day, you know, because of the new federal regulations, the concerns of companies of allergens, they'll write, you know, may have trace dairy or peanuts, right? Well, the traces, when they say trace, they're talking about, you know, they could be parts per million only. But right, I mean, that's the Mesiris Nefesh that you have to have. You know, people assume that we can't manage it in such a way that we have so much information on the label to accommodate, you know, things that are, you know, a person can easily survive without, you know. Rami?
After World War II, this country, many of the applied to
Right. Well, the word glut has many meanings. Just to analyze, why is it that some people look for glut? There are two. I actually wrote an article about this once in the this year in the Forward. There are two reasons that glut is important. I mean, halachically significant. One reason is there's a machlok between the Mechaber and the Ramah about sirchus. Sirchus is an adhesion to the lung, which can represent a puncture in the lung. Machlokes Rashi and Tosfos exactly what the lachos sirchus. I'm not going to go into this right now, but a puncture in the lung, whether it's covering up a puncture or potentially could be punctured, is a trefer. So according to the Beis Yosef, that sirch itself makes the animal trefer. The Ramor was more lenient, and he said that if the sircha can be taken off easily, so that's not treif. So first of all, for Svardim, who follow not the Ramor but the Mechaber but the Beis Yosef, they want to be more stringent about the definition of glut. So their definition of glut is a more stringent one. However, the Chassidish definition of glut is that small sirchus, what they call rearing, right, don't make the animal treif, and that those that come off very easily by the Bodik Chutz, they call that glut as well. This is not just some invention that Satman made when he came to the United States. If you look in the Simla Chadosha, which, you know, was the, so to speak, the Bible of Shochtim, 200 years ago, approximately, when it was written. So he has that standard as well. And the question is whether that standard is sufficient for those Svardim who are being makbid on the Beis Yosef, Mi'ikur Adin. Some say it is, some say it's not. But there's another reason that glut is important, and that is not just because the machlokes between the Chab and the Ramor, but the Gemara tells us, and it's based on the Pasuk in Novi, that Yecheskel HaNovi never ate, and one talks about Rav, that he never ate meat Shehorah B'chochem. That was even an issue that required a rendering of a decision. Non-glat by definition requires a rendering of a decision, because the Boidik has to make a decision, is this Sircha, and you need a certain level of expertise, is it kosher or is it not? Is it coming off easily? Is it not coming off easily? So that is already, would not meet the standard of Yecheskel, of Shehorah B'chochem. That's what Rami mentioned before. So glat, those are the two advantages to glat. It used to be in America, before the war, there was no such thing as glat. Glat came with Satmar. I mean, there are lots of reasons why, not only halachic reasons, communal reasons, economic reasons, but ultimately it set the standard for everybody else. And there was another advantage that people looked to for glut, and that was there was tremendous corruption in the meat industry in the United States. You know, the Ritvaz, who later moved to Tzvat, he lived for a while in Chicago. This is in the 1920s, and he wanted to change, you know, the meat industry. Well, the meat industry then was in the most unsavory hands in Chicago. You know, Chicago, I don't have to say what Chicago represented in the 1920s. So he left in the middle of the night because they, you know, he was threatened, and that's why he left. So people started to look for glut because they didn't care about glut. They're not, you know, what they were willing to rely on the Ramor, but they wanted to have more confidence that it was Boshet Kosher, that the Shochtim was Shomer Shabbos, which wasn't always the case, and that they were qualified Shochtim. So that's what glut then became to mean. And as it emerged, glut became a consumer phrase, meaning, you know, mahadrin. So it's a word that's, you know, became ripped of its original context. Glut, of course, in Yiddish means smooth, cholok, that there are no sirchus. Somehow became attached not only to chickens, where there aren't so problems of sirchus on the lungs of chickens, but even to cheese and other things where it just completely, you know, doesn't mean anything. So the word glut has metamorphized in terms of its meaning.
Not that the Yiddish Hashkacha is the owner of Hashem.
generally speaking, we do have restaurants that are not Shomer Shabbos. Actually, the Teveri right in this area is owned by a goy. But a good guy is better than sometimes from a year because he's not his own poistigan. But what the OU did do was that we generally, I can't say without exception, but we generally look for Shomer Shabbos people in terms of the meat operation. This was not only our own invention, but this was a recommendation that we had from the Attorney General of Illinois when we had our own Tuchval. This goes back 20 years ago. I think Jerry actually was involved in that, in the correction of it, not in the. So, wasn't an investor. So we do, and that's why what happened was, I have to give Rabbi Grumblatt, Rabbi Yosef Grumblatt, he was the one within the Kashrus who was always pushing for this, that we should have Shomer Shabbos people as the major players in the meat operation. And in fact, that's what we have now. The main meat supply is Yanki Chaimowitz, Ali, Shehamda, the Rubashkins. Those are the main suppliers, and they're all from a Yidden. So the distribution chain that goes through, at least in the production side. But I can't say that it's completely that way, as I indicated. West Side, here on the West Side, you have that restaurant, but that's generally the case, but not without exception.
When it's not a Shomer Shabbos, whether Gentile or non-religious Jews, keys are totally in the hands of the mashgiach.
Right.
They can't enter the restaurant without the mashgiach opening it for them.
Well, they can't enter the commissaries and the cooking
where
areas.
The food is.
Right.
Packaging,
you
sometimes notice that
there's
an OU symbol. Sometimes
there's
an OU
parva
symbol. What is
the
difference between them?
We don't tell people that they have to put the parva on. You can assume, but again, you should be careful about this because there's always the potential of a mistake, a printing mistake. But if it just says OU and there's no dairy ingredients listed in the panel, I mean, I only say no dairy ingredients because, as an additional check, you can assume that it's PAV. And the common dairy ingredients that are used are whey, casein, and of course, milk, cheese, but lactose is a milk sugar. So those are the main indicators of a dairy ingredient. But if it just says OU, you can assume that it's PAV. No. You see that? I don't know the supervision there, but I'm sure that the case, like I told you before, that's probably because of allergen potential contamination, and the parts might be, tiny, certainly bottled, even it would be mixed in. But those are the kind of things that, requires a little seichel sometimes. You would know not to give supervision for that. My mother used to say, seichel is doch ein edel azach, right? So I'll give another example in terms of the OU. We always request, and I just had a request again last week, to give supervision on dog food. So I said, I know it's an extra account, but we're not going to do it, And even though there's what, the truth is, al-pidin, there's what to give supervision for, because there are big problems in terms of basar b'cholov in dog food. Chametz b'Pesach, so kosher Pesach dog food, all right. But it's a whole new,
Not
kebrach. Right. Well, glycerin, in terms of medicines generally, the liquid medicines are something that have to be looked into very carefully. I want to give you an example. The Robitussin has glycerin, and it's an animal source glycerin. So, unless it's Pikuach Nefesh, and there are other alternatives, people shouldn't choose Robitussin. However, Tylenol for children, when I checked it last, the Tylenol was not from an animal source. If you call the company, they'll tell you. So, but it's the kind of thing that you have to check. if you just call the company, there's usually a consumer number, an 800 number, and you ask them that question, they'll tell you. But I've checked the Tylenol one, so you don't have to call for that one.
You mentioned before, I think, that there's a lot of confusion regarding the hashkafas given in the Yisrael. Do you at all considering being involved in hashkafas in the Yisrael, or is that politically not
the supervisions, the situation in Yisrael became much, much more complicated in the last several years. You know that the person who gave the head of the Kashrus division in Yerushalayim, Rabbi Adler, for many years, was dismissed, and there was a time that Omri Sharon was serving as the chief rabbi of Israel. Since he went to jail, he's given up that position. But this is not just a problem in terms of Kashrus; it's a problem just in terms of the Israeli system that requires real review. There is a chok onav b'kashrut in Israel. But the government, especially since Shinui came in, hasn't given the resources to the religious establishment, and maybe they didn't do such a good job, frankly, before, with what they had, and because of that, the system really requires tikkun. So. That doesn't mean to say that it's completely broken, and if you go to the Mahadran hotels in Yerushalayim, that they're not reliable. They probably are. It's just that it did create a sense of unease amongst the consumers, and we hear this a lot of times. We've spoken, for example, the Renaissance Hotel is coming now under the OU also. And one of the reasons I spoke to Harvey Dugman, who's the manager there, is he hears it all the time from parents who have, their kids are learning in Yerushalayim, and they don't want to eat in one of the hotels. They heard Rabbi Yosef said, not to eat in these hotels. And so they want to have a symbol that they're familiar with and that gives them more confidence. And that's unfortunate. It should be, we see it play out in lots of different areas. Now with El Al in terms of the Shabbos issue. We had it before with El Al in terms of the Kashrus issue. It's something that requires... everything in Israel is party oriented and government driven, which is unfortunate. In America, it's not that way, and maybe they would have a better system if there wasn't so much government control. It's not that the government does such a great job in everything. I don't want to mention that there was a war that we didn't do so well in Lebanon recently. So, I don't know. It's I often quote Henry Adams once said. That the progression of presidents from Washington to Grant disproves the theory of evolution. So I don't want to say it, but we have Ehud Olmert now, So all of these things are all mixed together. It's not just Kashrus per se. It's the political, and it's not just. I don't mean to say that the secular parties are all to blame. The religious establishment is also to blame. It's this mix is a toxic brew, in terms of how things are ultimately worked out in Israel. But it does. But I don't mean to say. But I want to emphasize again that everything is just a mix-up and no good. That's just not the case.
Talking about the Mahadran hotels in Yerushalayim, one of my friends, a friend of yours, who's the head of also very involved in Ashkata, said he mentioned that the Mahadran hotels in Yerushalayim are a Mahadran level that we can't even buy unless you go to the back room of Rubashkin, which is the Beis Yosef Chalak, and that the regular Ashkata that they have of the Rabban at Yerushalayim. Is the typical black hashkafa that we have in America, but the Mahadran and the Mahadran is in fact a Beis Yosef black. Is that?
I don't know if that's true. I don't think that it may be true. I'm not sure that all the hotels are using Beis Yosef glass necessarily.
When they say that they're Mahadran and a Mahadran.
They have. I didn't even know they had Mahadran. How many candles have they?
Again,
is Mahadran and Mahadran and Mahadran? It could be. I don't know. I went through what I called the glass hotels and is the Mahadran hotels under the Rabbanut, and from what I saw, it seemed to me that they were very much in order. I don't want to give supervision to, there's the Plaza, there's the Renaissance, there's a whole bunch of them, and the hotels I thought were, from what I saw, walk through the kitchen one time, I thought that the Meshkichim knew what they were doing and that they gave good supervision. And they're closely monitored, actually, by somebody within the Rabbanut of Yerushalayim, this Pella Bornstein.
That's what he told me.
Right, but you know, he has a little bit of an agia to tell you that, so.
What is your opinion on badats in Israel?
I think that, well, there are many badats, but you mean the badats Eide Charedis?
When
you say badats tam, you mean Eide Charedis. I think they're excellent. We work very closely with them. Well, obviously, if you're going to trade hotels, if they don't have an isolated, you know, some of them have their own separate kosher kitchens. But if they don't have their separate kitchen, so it means you have to kasher. But the mashgichim know what they're doing when they're kashering, and they, you know, I presume they're doing a good job. I'm not talking about just OU. I'm talking about, you know, all the various different supervisions that they have. The OU doesn't have that many actually caterers under its supervision. You know, actually, Rabbi Eisen is really, once again, I refer you to Rabbi Eisen, has much more experience in this in terms of the different hotels and the caterers. But I don't think it's so much the hotel. It's, you know, who's the supervision that they know how to set up things to set it up well. I mean, there are certain supervisions in the United States that are complete charlatans. I don't think any of you, you know, they're worth not only nothing, because they're deceptive and. So, but I don't know that they give supervision necessarily on caterers. There are, I'm talking about in products. So, you know, Americans get so used to that, you know, everything is kosher, that, you know, they're not demanding at all. They'll, whatever it is, if it has any ashkoch at all, there's one person who gives ashkoch on cheeses, which are very sensitive, and it's just, it's all green asakam, and I don't even think he ever heard the word green asakam even in his life. But he, I think ultimately you have to turn to your love as your first resource to ask him, and there are, you know, the OU itself will, you know, tell Labonim and so on what it thinks based on its own evaluation, its own information, what it thinks about different hashkochas. But you know, we don't put it up on our website. It's not, I mean, we do feel responsible to serve the community, but we can't respond to a consumer that calls and says, well, what do you think about this supervision, you know. We would not, unless I knew the person personally, I would not respond, because you know, or a particular, you know, again, a restaurant, a supervision, that's not something. But we would relate to different rabbonim, you know, what the information is. Well, in OU we require that they toivel all their kalim. There are many, that's the OU's policy. There are many hashkochas. I know boys are told this way, that they say it's not clay suda, it's clay schoira, because you're using it, you know, for business. I think it's a very shvacha heta, but there are those that rely on that. What I would say is this, that the OU's policy is represented by different people's positions, which means to say, in terms of the issue of the copepods, there were different opinions about Alpidin. Did you have to be cautious for this? First of all, what was the statistics, the Matzias, and are copepods a problem? David Feinstein, was a very reliable person, he thought it was a very big issue, a real concern. And the others who thought it was less than a Belsky thought it wasn't a problem. I mean, so what the OU is trying to service, you know, something as basic as that, a general constituency. So we're not taking a position to say, you know, the copepods are really schwatzen, that you have to, you know, they're so prevalent and you have to worry about it. We're saying we're going to try to accommodate everybody when they come to our restaurant, that they can drink the water. So we filter the water in all our restaurants. But what you should do in your house is not something that OU would tell you what to do. That you should really, you know, ask your local love. That may be you. But my point is, first of all, that's generally not the role of the OU. But it's really not such a davar poshut, you know. What Leibelsky thought, I know he lives in Brooklyn. They tell me he doesn't filter his water. He doesn't think it's required. He wrote a long chew about it. I think it was printed in the Masifta in Tovadas. So, you know, there are just different opinions about it. And you should. So in terms of what the OU does, though, is it filters the water in its own establishments to accommodate people who are concerned about it.
And there's been no change.
No change. No.
Blended scotches, or Uber spoke about it yesterday. What's the position of the OU or your own position on a single wood scotch that's not from a wooden cast, that's from a cast that's a sherry cast?
Well, you know, as you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein was a maker about this. Rav Moshe writes in his Tshuva to Rabbi Teitz that if it's blended with wine, since the amount that's blended with is less than 1 to 6, and we rely on the Ravid. The Ravid says, Alpidim, we rely on the Ravid, but he said that the Ravid doesn't only mean that it's bottled in water, but in other drinks also. That's Rav Moshe's opinion. However, there are those who disagree. And therefore, at OU Caterers, we don't give supervision necessarily on different whiskeys, but or scotches. But we would tell our caterer, that's what we'd come at, or our restaurant, you know, not to carry those scotches, just to accommodate everybody. But again, that's an example where there are different opinions. I remember Rabbi Teitz, Zichron Levracha, once told me, said, you know, this is a real, you know, here he said, Rav Moshe was trying to make it easy to be a Jew in America, as if there was such a big avera to make it easy to be a Jew in America. I thought that, you know, but there are different opinions, and, you know, even amongst the Rishonim, you know, there are a lot of different shittas about Stam Yenim in terms of what the Shia Bitlus have been. The time held, it's not bottled at all, it's like a Vodazora. Other shittas held, it's bottled the Shishim. The Ravid says it's bottled the Sheish. So. The OU does not give supervision on cruises, and we haven't given it for two reasons. One reason is because it's, you know, if you have a problem in the middle of the ocean, it's going to be hard to resolve in terms of, you know, obviously, and a lot of these cruises are not all, as you said, they're not only a kosher operation. Even with a completely kosher operation, we thought, you know, problems can always arise on a cruise. The other problem we actually have, once an interesting shot that came up, there was a cruise that they asked us to give supervision on to Alaska. At that time, the president of the OU was dying to go on that cruise. It was on somebody else's supervision. In fact, he went anyhow. But the reason we didn't give was there were issues with the international dateline where it was going. And we didn't want to get involved with the machlokes between the Herzog and the Chazon Ish in terms of Shabbos and so on, so because it was going above the Arctic Circle. So we didn't give supervision. I remember also speaking to David Feinstein about that at the time, just to mention, you know, and he said, you know, you're not mechuyev to go, you don't have to give a hashgacha because somebody wants to go or get involved in the shalva of the Arctic Circle, so we didn't give supervision.
What's your personal feeling about that argument?
I don't know. You know, some of them I'm sure are good, and so I'm not in a position. No. Yeah. But I said Rav Moshe, no?
I read an interview from the Badat. They have a person to Kevin.
I think the answer is this. The so-called Hamisha Hashkochas, Hamisha doesn't mean anything at all. It depends. Miva miha holchim. You mentioned, for example, the badats, right? So they have in terms of ingredients, one of the world's experts. Right. But for example, Rabbi Binder, who works for the badats, he's a real pro, and he's a real maven in ingredients. And a lot of this, of course, comes from avodasim chanchosim through the experience of working on this. But so it depends who they are and what they're doing. And you're right, some of them, but it's not limited to Hasidus, I don't disagree with you. I think, it depends, especially, a lot of people giving supervision don't have the infrastructure that you need in terms of knowing and getting access to a lot of information about ingredients, and that sometimes is a problem. I agree. Oh, absolutely. Not some. All. No, because we're not working for the Hamish Hashkochas. We don't work for the Yochai Verov or these people. They'll come into an OU thing and then they'll put a stamp on. They'll call Chaim Goldzweig, and that's the extent of their research. But that's the problem that happened in Muncie. You can't just rely on the nemonis of the guy. Even if you're going to give supervision, you should have a system in place that you can actually. That doesn't mean you won't make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, and sometimes they make blunders. Big mistakes. It's inevitable. It happened. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a day if a woman. I'm dating myself. Or somebody in the kitchen, whoever it is, right? Is cooking. If things never got mixed up, there'd never be who would have to write a year a day? We'd be shachar taz. Yeah.
In those cases where that should be refused because of packaging, is that legitimate
anyway? Yeah, absolutely. We talked about it before. Right. So I told you, for example, we don't give on dog food, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant the labeling on the packaging.
No, I meant the packaging. Assuming that it's, let's say, it's a cereal, but they don't put the picture of the kid is not his.
Oh, I misunderstood what you meant. Actually, we're being done on that. There's a company right now, I don't know. I don't remember a case where it happened to the OU, but I know that this became just not related to this. When the Badaks gave Hashgacha in Israel to Pepsi Cola. So I knew the owner. His name was Bornstein. He was actually one of the wealthiest people in Israel. So he gave super. He owned Tempo then, and he told me the worst thing he ever did was that he got the badats to give Ashka. Why? Because then they ran. The Pepsi had, if you remember, they had an air campaign in the United States and also apparently in Israel, of a person from it sort of was like a succession of pictures from an ape to a human. I guess it was. Moving up the evolutionary scale till you got to Pepsi Cola. So, that was the air can. And the Badats thought this was apikursus, they're endorsing evolution. So the Badats said that if you don't get rid of that air campaign, we're taking away the Ashkocha. So this for Bornstein, he just bought Pepsi Cola. He didn't mean to get involved in this theological argument about evolution, the poor man. I'm just reminding myself in terms of we are going in terms of packaging. All these things. It depends. What's on the picture. But what's not on the picture? I should say. It's something that has to be reviewed. You can't answer in the abstract.
Many years ago, Martin's candy used to have an equal line of Easter candy, which did not have DOE on it.
Right. But we, for example, we have, people complain to us, you gave them Coca-Cola, and it has a picture of Santa Claus and things like that. So, as Katoini, that's what we do. We don't. So, right. Okay, I think Rabbi Eisen is here. And it's not necessarily, I mean, we won't do it if it's a complete embarrassment, but it's not necessarily an approval of him. We always send, independent of who's there, we always send our own person to every supervision. But that doesn't mean to say, for example, in Eretz Yisrael, we work very closely with the Badats. It doesn't mean if the Badats are sending us Mashgichim that we're going to send our own independent school of Mashgichim to check. We will send our own person, Rabbi Kuba, but we will, you know, factor in that based on our relationship with the Badats, what they're doing as well.
Okay, I'd like to thank Rabbi Gnash. Very nice. You handled yourself well for some tough questions.